I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. Poet and novelist Maya Angelou once said that even though she'd written many books, she still feared that people would find out she had been, quote, running a game on everyone. Academy Award winner Kate Winslet told an interviewer that in the morning before a shoot, she'd think, I can't do this. I'm a fraud. Jodie Foster thought it was a fluke when she won an Oscar and worried that she'd have to return the statuette. Michelle Pfeiffer admitted back in 2002 that she thought people would find out she wasn't talented and that her success had been a sham. Why would such talented people, women in this case, doubt their abilities in spite of all the evidence to the contrary? We're going to explore what's been called the imposter syndrome or the imposter phenomenon with our two guests. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Julie Cohen. She's CEO of Julie Cohen Coaching. That's a career and personal coaching firm. She's also the author of a book called Your Work, Your Life, Your Way, 7 Ways to Work-Life Balance. Julie Cohen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you here. And joining us by telephone is Holly Hutchins. She's Associate Professor of Human Resource Development at the University of Houston's College of Technology, author of 2 studies on the imposter phenomenon, one called Outing the Imposter, the other called Coping with the Imposter. And Holly Hutchins, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much, Marty.
Holly, how do you define, I know you don't like the word syndrome, how do you define imposter phenomenon?
So I can give you sort of a clinical definition or just sort of my own definition. And I'll start with my own definition first. It's just the persistent feelings of inadequacy or not feeling like you're quite good enough, and to the extent that you feel like a fraud, that someone made a mistake in your selection and your recognition for an award, and that you are trying very hard not to be found out.
Have you ever felt that?
Oh, definitely. As a tenure-track professor, so early faculty member, I felt that a lot. The transition between going from a graduate student into your first major career position, you do feel like, or I did feel like, I was constantly questioning my ability, almost like somehow they made a mistake in hiring me. And that creates a lot of anxiety. It can cause also depression. And often people struggle in silence with that. And it wasn't until I could normalize that by hearing other stories of some of the same feelings that I was able to move on.
And you learned you weren't alone. Well, early on in radio, I think I actually was an imposter because, truth be told, I didn't actually know what I was doing. But, Julie, have you ever experienced that feeling of being an imposter?
Yeah, I have. I remember one of the first pieces of feedback I received as a young professional from a boss who I loved was that I needed to work more on extemporaneous public speaking. And it turns out that became a big part of my job. And so I remember some of the first times in front of a room, I kept thinking, what am I doing here? Who are people going to, you know, are they going to believe me? And what if I mess up? I'm just, a hair away from, everyone finding out that I'm not really good at this.
But it seems there's a difference between people starting out in a career when you really feel like you are finding your or feeling your way, and someone like Kate Winslet, who's an award-winning actor, saying every morning before I go on the set, I feel like I'm a fraud. What's the difference there that you see?
Yeah, so I see with my clients, sometimes there is some type of catalyst in the past that they carry with them, and they're not able to get over that, even with, like the accolades you were talking about, the people you highlighted, but people who are extremely accomplished, effective in their role, and yet, they're waiting. I liken it, they're waiting for that other shoe to drop. I'm going to do something, or, the mask is going to be, pulled off, and they're going to see I'm not competent.
But is that just insecurity, or is there something deeper than that?
Well, for my role as an executive coach, we actually don't go look in the past to say why. It's let's identify it, and that's a really critical point. How do we know what's happening, and then what can we do about it? So I don't focus on the why. Mm-hmm. I focus on, okay, this is happening. What's the impact, and what can we do about it?
Well, let's put the why to you, Holly. what's the driver here, do you think?
I think the driver – so the research is a little mixed on this. A lot of the early research – focus on aspects of depression, prior depression, prior anxiety, also around gender stereotyping and sometimes family patterns. So what kind of messages were communicated to to daughters and sons about their worth. A lot of, and Julie, I think, mentioned this, a lot of imposters tend to be perfectionists, tend to work really hard at achievement and are well-regarded in their field as experts. I mean, you mentioned a kind of a list of individuals earlier. I would add that, that even men do are challenged with this. Don Cheadle and Denzel Washington have spoken about some of their challenges with this. What we do know for sure is that the other piece of that definition, it's a bit more on the clinical side, and that is the inability to attribute success to internal reasons. So Kate Winslet talking about, you know, feeling like a fraud, often we, and I would say more women, tend to attribute success to being lucky, being in the right place, having a great team, and not really about my own intelligence, my own work ethic, et cetera. So if we've been conditioned around that, and I arguably more so women, to attribute success to other people, then that will come out in the way that we explain our achievement and our success, and that we explain our failure as something internal. So as much as imposters attribute success to external factors, we attribute in failure a lot to internal factors. I didn't work hard enough.
Right,
I wasn't smart enough. I need to do better. And we double down, and almost my research has shown that imposters tend to also experience more burnout than those scoring lower on the imposter spectrum.
Well, it's very stressful. I mean, clearly what you're describing there. Holly, let me pick up on something you said, and then, Julie, I'll get you back in on the conversation. This has to do with family patterns. I mean, is it as direct and perhaps even simple as, you know, growing up with parents who said, you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you're never going to make it? I mean, is it that overt, do you think?
No, actually, it can be overt, but I would argue that some of the research has shown actually the opposite. If we're, and parents do, I'm a parent, so I do this too, really acknowledging success and really focusing on, you do so well, you know, in this area, or, you know, scholastically, and setting an expectation where failure actually is not an option, or it's viewed perhaps negatively. So when I go into my first career, and I obviously all of us do this, we're kind of feeling our way around and adapting to new challenges, we are going to have missteps, we are going to have mistakes. Imposters really internalize that. And so growing up, if you weren't allowed to fail and make light of that, meaning, you know, learn from those experiences, gosh, we're adults, you know, the weight feels even heavier. So when we, you know, make a mistake or maybe don't perform the way that we want to. So I would argue that it's not just the negative messages. It's also not balancing enough of the negative messages, right, or constructive messages with the positive messages. So kids who grew up feeling like success was the only option tend to struggle more when they have difficulties later on in adult.
Well, let's
in their adulthood.
Julie, let's talk about adults. So how do you help someone who has these kinds of feelings that somehow they have to be perfect? If they don't perform at some high level, they're going to be found out as some kind of a sham or a fraud.
So the first step is actually identifying it. So when my clients come to me, my clients are all highly successful, highly effective people. And kind of going back to something, you know, both you and Holly mentioned, what happens is there's this heaviness that they're carrying around that they feel they have to work extra hard so, you know, they don't get found out, or that, you know, they're not going to be put in that situation where, you know, what they may feel is their fatal flaw is going to be put on display. So often we start, when does this happen?
Right.
I've found it's often situational, you know, because these people are very successful and they've had, you know, a track record of accomplishment. So usually it might happen around a skill area. It might happen around a specific situation or working with a specific person, you know, someone you respect, or, you know, there's a lot at stake. So first is the piece of identification. When is this happening? And then we look at different strategies to pause that voice. And so, you know,
what do you say to that voice, though?
Well, that's the thing. So that voice, you know, as a coach, we often call that one's gremlin. You know, it's what's that little monster?
You say grandma.
Oh, no, no.
Gremlin. Gremlin.
That's a different voice. That's on the other shoulder. That's giving you the pat on the back. The gremlin is saying, you know, oh, you know, it's you're just a step away from getting found out. You know, if you do this, people might find out. So first identifying it. And then, you know, it's hard to sometimes lower it if it's been with you for a lot of time. So what I always want my clients to do is to start looking for evidence and to be able to step out of, you know, that, you know, when that voice rears its head and say, what are your strengths? We do a lot of focus on quantifying strengths and competencies, what you're good at. Let's look at feedback you've gotten over the last 1, 2, 5, 10 years. And be able to see the distinction between, okay, one situation may have caused this, and you are more than that.
I mean, it sounds like it's a reality check, which is, okay, you've got this gremlin that's telling you you're not good enough, in a sense, or that you're going to be found out, and you're saying, let's throw reality up against and what, sort of have an argument or use the evidence,
I guess? Well, actually, that's one of the things we do. It's called an evidence journal, where I might encourage, you know, a client to open a document or, you know, even an old-fashioned handwritten journal when you're feeling it, what's going on, and then how do you pause and say, let's look at reality. You know, what's happening, really? What are the strengths I bring? If this does happen, how do I resolve it? And so we get very present about, you know, their competencies, their skills and abilities.
Holly, does that make sense?
It does. And in some of the interviews that I conducted after the survey, in one of the studies, a lot of faculty expressed that having mentors or support system to really challenge, and I call these cognitive distortions, you know, errors in thinking about how you do attribute success and failure, were very powerful. And I completely agree with what Julia said, that those have to be, in some ways, visible, whether it's, you know, creating a checklist of all the things that you've done, successes that you've done. And these can be small. They don't have to be huge. Like in my world, it would be, you know, a major grant or a paper being accepted. It could be really small, incremental things that really challenge those distortions in thinking about how we value ourselves and how we handle success and failure. And the other piece of this is these typically are highly successful individuals. So even in the face of all these successes, they're still feeling fraudulent. So I completely agree. That was one of the techniques that we found as well, that having someone coach you or even having other types of evidence to challenge those distortions were really helpful.
Well, we're almost up on a break here, but what I hear you saying, Holly, is that if you get in the mind of someone who feels like they're an imposter, is that they are not responsible for their success and they are responsible for their failures. So, you know, they don't get any credit, right, from themselves.
Exactly. And even hearing other people praise them, it sometimes accentuates the effect, meaning that you don't really mean that, or they begin discounting other people's praises. So it does take work. There's rarely a time where I've heard individuals, or even personally, it takes one or two instances of, like, you know, validating your own successes. I mean, it takes a while to really break down and challenge some of those distortions.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Holly Hutchins and Julie Cohen. We are talking about feeling like an imposter, often called the imposter syndrome or the imposter phenomenon or imposter tendencies. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. I see comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @whyyradiotimes. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Have you ever felt like this? Felt like a fraud, that you were going to be found out as incompetent, that your success was because of dumb luck, not anything that you did? There's a name for it. It's called feeling like an imposter. And that's what we're talking about with our guest, Holly Hutchins, Associate Professor of Human Resource Development at the University of Houston's College of Technology. She's done a number of studies on imposter phenomenon, outing the imposter and coping with the imposter. Also with us is Julie Cohen. She's CEO of Julie Cohen Coaching, a career and personal coaching firm, author of a book called Your Work, Your Life, Your Way, 7 Keys to Work Life Balance. And again, we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @whyyradiotimes. Holly, if I can go back to you, do you think there's something shame-based about feeling like an imposter?
No, actually. I mean, I think it's actually quite common. And even though my research has identified it happening a lot with early career professionals, it is something that really any time in my interviews, at least, pour out, it can happen any time where there's a significant change in one's career where you really move into a period of uncertainty. So even though it can happen, again, and Julie's comments to the support, mm-hmm. that it can typically happen when you begin a career, there are certain critical change points within the same career that this can happen as well.
And I'm curious, we were talking about this briefly during the break, Julie, about whether, I mean, the examples, and I even see from our comments here, they're all coming from women. Is this something you think that women have to deal with more often than men?
Hold on, Holly.
I'm going to toss that to Julie, and then I'll get you in.
I definitely see, you know, in the people who bring it up with me, it's definitely a more female-based challenge. And there are, you know, I've had male clients who struggle with this. I don't like to, you know, stereotype, and yet there seems to be this concern. And, you know, I don't know if it's environmental or, the organizational culture or, you know, the history that they bring to it. But, there are definitely men who are impacted by it. But again, for my sample set, it's not as pervasive with men.
What have you found, Holly?
I found that that women definitely reported higher levels of imposter experiences or tendencies. I tend to play around with the wording, calling it tendencies or experiences. But in the interviews where I did interview the same number of men and women, I had men almost in a hushed tone, even though it was just me and my graduate student and that them in the room. They were speaking softly, as if other people, they didn't want anybody else to hear that they were. They really did struggle with feeling inadequate, and for faculty members especially, as soon as we achieve, I would say even a master's level achievement, but certainly a PhD or an EDD, a doctoral degree, we are recognized as experts. And so I had several faculty, men and women, say, as soon as I hear that expertise label, like we're contacted for interviews such as this, they shudder and think, "Oh my gosh, why? You know, I don't feel like an expert." So men did talk quite candidly about that, and some men who were first generation educators, first in their family to go on for an advanced degree, also talked about feeling like that in their degree experience, in their program experience. So. Back to what are some other factors that can influence this, that did play out quite a bit, and mostly with men, which is interesting in my findings.
Yeah, very interesting. Julie, you had a reaction.
Yeah, Holly just brought up something, you know, as I was thinking about, you know, my male clients that I have struggled with it. Sometimes they see themselves not as the norm. They know this. And sometimes for my male clients that it comes to mind, they've been more introverted or, you know, they don't see themselves as the other guys, and so there's something that they've already set themselves off. I'm different. I have different competencies and different skills, and they may not be as valued, you know, in the workplace. So that's the only piece that, you know, that I definitely see as a potential pattern.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Aaron from Port Richmond joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
First time calling in. It's a very interesting show, and I love
Good.
The show.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if the experts have any knowledge of a study called the Dunning-Kruger effect, in which people were given tasks like origami to do, and those who were not particularly skilled at a task rated themselves much better at that task than they actually were. And inversely, people who were well-trained in a task were given the same task and scaled themselves or rated themselves much lower on the scale, and wondering if the experts have any knowledge of that study, or also, like, what if you actually are an imposter? Like,
exactly.
I'd like to hear about,
no, that's
about that.
Aaron, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Can you weigh in on that, Holly?
Sure. Aaron, that's a great question. I'm not familiar with the Dunning-Kruger study, but I am familiar with studies that look at self-ratings of performance. And what you've talked about is not unusual, which goes back to this idea of efficacy around the skill, you know, how well we do feel about our confidence or ability. What's interesting, and I'd be curious to see if there are gender differences in that,
yeah.
because typically men will overrate their ability, and typically women will underrate their ability. And when you get a third party or another person to actually rate, it's typically the other person will, like a manager, will rate the women higher and rate the men about the same. So it is interesting how we actually rate ourselves in terms of that. And you mentioned another part of your question concerning imposters. Was it a coping question, Aaron, or?
I think he really just had a more sort of intellect. He was just curious about your response to this particular study. But let me get Julie in the conversation. I mean, what I'm hearing from both of you and even looking at the screens here is that people don't have a realistic view of themselves. I mean, either they overrate themselves, they underrate themselves.
Yeah, well, following up on what the caller just said, to me, what's interesting about that one finds what's called the enthusiastic beginner. They learn, you know, a new skill. They're new at the job, and, you know, their enthusiasm can be really compelling, and they're ready to take on the world, but they may actually not have the competencies. So, you know, their effectiveness doesn't catch up with their enthusiasm. Then they get through another stage, and then that's when the reality hits, and I get that first performance review. Oh, I thought it was really good, and I'm not getting – so then there's this dissonance between my belief and, you know, the results that other people's – you know, the perceptions of others. So that can actually be a point where the imposter syndrome, depending on how you interpret that. So there's an interpretation there, too. How do you interpret feedback that you're giving when you're not great?
Well, exactly, because if you get good feedback, you're going to say, no, you know, they don't really know what's going on with me.
Right. And so that's some of the ways we address the imposter syndrome is, you know, I talked about this evidence, but, you know, I might encourage clients to share with me, you know, your past, you know, a couple of performance reviews. Let's look at those together. And, you know, most of the time they are stellar.
Holly, I'm curious about, is there a connection between feeling like an imposter and burnout on the job?
Yes. In fact, I wanted to do a study that linked it to work outcomes because the research up to this point really linked it more to individual aspects, really more psychosocial aspects such as depression, anxiety, or just the persistence of imposter tendencies. So my study looked at the link between imposter tendencies and burnout, job performance, and work satisfaction. And what we found were highly significant linkage between those that report moderate to high levels of imposter tendencies and burnout, and lower connections to job performance and work satisfaction, which means individuals were experiencing high levels of burnout or exhaustion, as we call it, and rating them much lower on job performance and work satisfaction.
So
that's obviously not good for, you know, employers to know in terms of the impact of those struggling with this.
But it sounds like if someone is experiencing burnout and they feel like an imposter, they're doing an impossible job. I mean, they're being asked to do a job they feel like they can't do well. Holly?
I'm not sure if they're being asked to do something that they can't do well. It's the emotional, I think, the baggage or the load that they're carrying. So, you know, imposters, if they're experiencing depression, if they're experiencing this constant cycle of doubt, it is having a negative impact on their performance and overall on their work satisfaction. And so it was not surprising to me to find that their individuals were more prone to being burned out. They were exhausted. They were having very low levels of satisfaction with the work they were doing because they weren't feeling the success of all that work. They weren't internally validating their worth in terms of the work. So it did feel like, you know, they were putting out a lot more than they were getting back. So, and one of the challenges with this is that we don't want individuals to leave the profession. So as faculty, we invest a lot of money, and Julie knows this well, and there's, you know, almost $100,000, you know, you can put in recruiting, selecting, recruiting, and onboarding.
You know what, Julie? Holly, we're gonna try to put you on a better phone line because there have been times when we haven't heard everything that you've had to say. So Why don't you hang up? We'll call you back, and we'll get you back on the show. And let me just reintroduce everybody. Julie Cohen is with us here in our Philadelphia studio, CEO of Julie Cohen Coaching. That's a career and personal coaching firm. And once we get Holly Hutchins back, she is with the University of Houston's College of Technology. And she's done some studies on imposter phenomenon or imposter tendencies. And that's what we're talking about on Radio Times. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Julie, just picking up on what Holly was talking about this kind of sense of burnout, and since you work with people, I mean, high-level people, it sounds like that they have a lot of demands and stresses, and once you kind of feel like you can't do it and perhaps you're an imposter, that's going to add to the kinds of stresses. How do you intervene?
Well, to acknowledge that, I think there's a heaviness that comes, you know, regardless of how big your job is and just the general, you know, responsibilities of completing your job successfully, if you're carrying around this weight of worry and, you know, having to potentially, you know, plan your behaviors so you're not found out, that adds to that. So, you know, I think we always, again, want to look at what the factors are and what one can do about it. So I'd want to know what's the impact of, you know, of this imposter syndrome and the overwhelm. You know, it may be as simple as, you know, how do you pause each day to start mm-hmm. your day in a way focusing on, you know, what you have to do and how you're going to accomplish it. Or, you know, patterns of, you know, ending your day and ending your week with, you know, reviewing what you've accomplished and the feedback you've gotten. And like we talked about earlier, being able to separate, you know, kind of the internal voices with, you know, the concrete, you know, feedback. So actually getting external feedback, uh-huh. you know, people hire me as a coach, but you can get feedback from so many other places mm-hmm. every day and really utilizing those sources.
Sort of saying, how did I do?
Yeah. Asking how do I do? Or, you know, if you have a friend, you know, I'm speaking, I'm in front of this group, I'm running this meeting, you know, afterwards, can you just give me, you know, some feedback? What went well? And, you know, what could I improve on? Mm-hmm. And so there's also a shift that needs to happen that my philosophy is all feedback is good feedback. And so being able to get comfortable with that can be really empowering.
And Holly, people that feel like imposters, can they hear that feedback, especially if it's positive?
Yeah, so I would offer an extension of what Julie just mentioned and say that, you know, really select individuals to give you feedback. I mean, there's obviously, you know, sometimes you don't have a choice in terms of your manager. And that is something that hopefully, you know, individuals get enough feedback so they can correct and adjust their behavior to that. But also there are friends and trusted sources that really can provide a good balance of feedback, constructive, and that the individuals are really going to trust, because right. we can get feedback from a lot of different sources. Some of those are trustworthy, really out for our best interest, and some of those might not be. So I would offer to select and to vary the resources or the sources of feedback that you get, but choose carefully in terms of that.
Let me see what Karuna from Kennett Square has to say. Karuna, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I actually wanted to talk about the idea that females reported more incidences of the imposter syndrome than males, uh-huh. Because I was actually wondering about the nuances of intersecting identities. For example, men of color who might feel like they're the diversity hire, mm-hmm. or generally just what the composition of those studies were, and if there have been or will be more research into those intersecting identities.
Okay. Karuna, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Can you take that, Holly?
Sure. That's a great question. So in a larger study that I did, which was over 300 faculty, 58% of the sample were women. And so while I did find a significant effect in terms of a gender difference, that effect wasn't just tremendous. So there was an effect, but there were also several men who did report having moderate to high imposter tendencies. I will say that the research up until this point, and the research goes back really to the late 70s, that started out finding a lot of gender differences, more in the way of more women, but over time, those really were neutralized. So as many women as men, or as many men as women, were reporting issues with this. When I got into my interviews is where you hear the lived experiences and the rich examples of these individuals. And I heard as much from men. Mm. In fact, at one point I just thought, wow, this is so powerful to hear these men talk candidly about some of the challenges. And several of these men were men of color. Several of the men were first-generation academics. And they gave lots of different examples about, and some were solo, meaning the only African-American male in their department, or Hispanic female in their department. So those accounts were quite poignant in terms of some of the additional challenges that they dealt with. Mm.
We talked earlier, Julie, about this notion of perfectionism, the idea that mm-hmm. someone that feels, or using your language, Holly, about imposter tendencies or the imposter experience, the idea that you have to do things perfectly. How do you address something like that?
Well, we look at the reality of, you know, what perfection is and what you know, what they're capable of. So I always try to just take perfection out of the discussion.
So you're not going to be perfect,
right? It's just, you know, that to strive for that, you're going to miss out on what you're doing well. And so, you know, so one of the first exercises I might do with someone is let's again, I talked about the performance reviews, but really look at your accomplishments over, you know, the past period of time that you're really proud of and or that you've gotten really good feedback on. And, you know, we it's not about perfection. It's about the results. And are you meeting the needs of, you know, your position, your team, you know, your organization? And so building them, kind of getting comfortable with being able to talk about this and identify when they do well.
So the idea is really a kind of an inventory, which is, you might be feeling this, but let's take a look at your track record.
Right.
Let's see what you have been able to accomplish.
Right. And I think there's a pivot that needs to happen. Yeah, I'm feeling this. You know, the stress is building, the heaviness, the overwhelm. How do I step out of it? And you know, sometimes there's some just physical things you need to do. You know, you may be preparing for, you know, a big project. You know, I need to get up, take a break, and say, you know, what am I doing well? What's the next steps? You know, what is leading me to success? So that may be another distinction, success versus perfection.
Ah, interesting. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Julie, you probably want to weigh in on that. And we are talking about tendencies, the experiences of being an imposter. It's almost painful to say the word. We got some just a couple of open lines at 1-888-477-9499. A lot of emails here, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. More from Julie Cohen and Holly Hutchins after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Holly Hutchins, joining us by telephone from Texas, where she is at the University of Houston's College of Technology. And she's done some interesting research on imposters or feeling like an imposter. Julie Cohen with us here in our Philadelphia studio, CEO of Julie Cohen Coaching, and that's a career and personal coaching firm. And we've got a bunch of people that want to join us, 1-888-477-9499. Holly, I heard you kind of exhale when Julie was talking about the difference between success and perfection. You want to weigh in on this, and then we'll get some more callers in on the conversation.
I do. I think the changing the narrative around perfectionism and really talking more about evidence-based success and showing that to individuals that struggle with imposter tendencies is wonderful. You know, individuals probably don't receive enough feedback and enough constructive feedback. So, you know, changing that from trying to hit, you know, a certain level of performance to let's look at the different ways that you've succeeded, both big and small. Mm-hmm. That definitely is powerful, and that it's received on a consistent basis. But I would also add that internally making those lists for yourself, because you're not always going to have someone, you know, telling you this information.
Sure.
So whether it's journaling, which Julie mentioned earlier, having lists that are visible that you can refer to when you start feeling, you know, the physiological feeling of like, oh, because most people describe that as sort of this hollow feeling in the stomach and a bit of fear and uncertainty coming up. So having different types of reminders for you is a good example.
Someone made a Facebook comment early on, and I'll just summarize here. She's been working in the field for something like 25 years and says, you know, I still at times feel like an imposter. I mean, here's someone who's been doing something mm-hmm. for a long, long time, but Julie, she still feels like she's she's going to be found out or she's going to be a fraud. That's a long time to feel like that.
It is a long time. And so, you know, again, from that information, we don't have that much to go with. But there'd be questions I'd want to ask her, if I was coaching her. So, you know, first of all, when does this happen? Is you know, as I mentioned, is this around specific situations? Is this all the time? And so, you know, as a coach, you know, if it's situational, it's much more easy to address in an action-oriented forward focus. You know, sometimes there are, you know, if it is pervasive and debilitating, then that person may need, you know, therapeutic help that they need to seek, you know, to address that. Again, what Holly said, the issue of, you know, visible reminders and getting feedback. Sometimes we need to ask our boss or others around us, you know, yeah, I'd like to talk more than, you know, the twice a year performance review. You know, can we have, you know, once a week updates where, you know, I tell you what's going on and you give me feedback. You know, it's tricky. Sometimes our boss says, you know, you'll hear from me if you're not doing well.
Yeah, yeah.
But for someone who struggles with this, that is not enough. You know, no news is not good news for someone like that. No news means I could be, you know, this close to, you know, getting the boot. So to ask for what you need is also another way to start, you know, to start moving in that direction of affirming your value in your roles.
Holly, a comment from Tom, and he was curious about whether this comes up with sports and competition. We've been focusing largely on the workplace, but do you think it can be applied? And I'm thinking of people that are really good athletes having to compete and perform at a really high level. Does this stuff work for them as well?
It wouldn't be surprising if it was. I haven't seen any research nor any sort of high-level sports figures that have talked openly about this. But at the same time, as we talk about, you know, some specific aspects of the workplace, I think the way that our climate in the workplace values success and failure also is important. So in the sports setting, an academic setting, and in other settings, you know, we don't talk a lot about failure and how we come back from that, or it's not necessarily expected. So I think climate has a lot to do with when people feel comfortable in sharing, which one of the coping strategies that I found in my research is the normalizing effect of having others talk about, like, it's a shared experience. So it wouldn't be surprising in the sports setting or the industry. Going, say, from a college to a pro situation, that those athletes would feel like that. But do they feel comfortable talking openly about it?
Well, Julie,
that's the question I would have.
Absolutely. And Julie, just picking up on that, I mean, do we have workplaces where people can, you know, reveal some of these vulnerabilities that they might feel?
Well, you just used the perfect word about vulnerability. So, you know, to build a great team, to build a work culture where you can be creative and take risks, having that space where you can be vulnerable is really empowering. If you have a leader or a boss of a team who says, you know, mistakes is how we grow, not, you know, don't do anything, you know, wrong, or, you know, you're going to, you know, lose, you know, your position, you know, make us fail. So creating that environment where one can be vulnerable without risk, I can help, you know, quiet that imposter.
Okay. Let me see what looks like Tom from Marion Station has to say. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. First of all, love your program, Marty.
Thank you.
And secondly, I just want to echo the comments that were just made by your guest about having a boss that sets up a kind of an open and candid environment. I have had one in the past, and it was just absolutely wonderful working for him, knowing that he was human and that you could be human around him and make mistakes and still continue in progress. But my question wants to go back to, or my point I want to go back to, is the comments that were made earlier about parents who tell their kids that they can't succeed or that they're never going to be good enough. And I wanted to flip the coin around and see if your guests have any comments around just the opposite, where you have helicopter parents telling their kids that they're the best, they can be anything they want to be, they're the smartest kid. And I have a nephew who just can't seem to pull the trigger on anything because I think he was told that as a younger kid, and now it just feels inadequate.
Oh, interesting. And Tom, we touched on this earlier. Holly was talking about, in fact, I asked her, is it people that have been criticized their whole life? She said, no, it often comes from people that have been told how great they are. I guess the implicit message was you have to be perfect. Can you expand on that, Holly?
I sure will. So when some of the research has pointed to family patterns. So in, say, a family of two or three, if you were sort of the son that always did everything well while your sister or brother were always kind of getting into trouble, there's a certain expectation set there that sort of becomes your identity, right? Whether it's scholastically, in your friendships, you know, maybe you don't give your parents any trouble, whatever. And so individuals internalize that as, I cannot step out. I cannot make mistakes. You know, I have a certain expectation to fulfill. And so when they, and some of that can be brought on by your comment about helicopter parents. If we don't learn how to make mistakes, recover from them, see them as a learning opportunity as children, then when we go into, when we make our developmental transitions, especially into adulthood, we really struggle with that. And it's an easy place to internalize that. Some people will say, oh, it's other people, it's my job, it's my boss. But individuals that have imposter tendencies will deeply internalize that and really have a difficult time adjusting to when they're not 100% or they're not perceived as meeting some level of expectation. So your question is well put. It does happen in those situations.
Sure. Tom, yeah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Anything you want to add to that, Julie?
Nope. I think she did great.
Well,
I have a tweet for you,
Julie, all from right. Cecily saying, is rating yourself based on what you think your supervisor would rate being an imposter? And we now have, you know, at work, you rate yourself, you know, based and rate your supervisor oftentimes.
Right, right.
It's that 360 degrees. And I guess the question is, if you're rating yourself based on what you think your supervisor is going to rate you on, does that make you an imposter?
Well, it's funny. I've had multiple clients when we do these 360 assessments where, you know, they get a lot of other people's feedback and then they give their own feedback. There's definitely a subset of the clients I've worked with. They consistently rate themselves lower than everyone. Mm-hmm. And then we look at that, and often it can be there's undiscovered strengths.
Uh-huh.
There's blind spots that
they don't see them.
They don't see them. And so that's where we work. And, you know, there's the flip side of that where people, you know, consistently rate themselves above how everyone sees themselves. And, you know, in some ways, you know, that is more damaging, you know, kind of on their career path, because what they're presenting outwardly, you know, is not matching, you know, what their expectations are. So, you know, there's different approaches to that. And that whole self-assessment in the workplace, you know, can be very tricky. And, you know, there's a lot of stress around that.
Yes,
just, oh, my goodness, I have to put this together. And what if the person thinks I'm, you know, full of myself? You know, that can be really challenging also.
Let me see what Andrew from Hamilton, New Jersey has to say. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. This is a great show.
Thank you.
I am a researcher, and in my field, I find that this imposter syndrome tends to be quite high just because of the amount of unknown in the field itself, when you're just trying to figure out an answer that there's no clear-cut answer to. So my question is, this imposter syndrome, have you correlated that to different fields or different professional sectors? Or more specifically, do you find the imposter syndrome more alive and well in academic sectors rather than professional sectors with more systematic work?
Andrew, let me toss that to Holly. I mean, she's done a lot of work. It's been, sounds like, Holly, largely on academics. But you want to weigh in on Andrew's question?
Sure, Andrew, that's a great question. Most of the research in the last 20 years has focused either on the medical professional setting, so medical residents, you know, future doctors in training, and graduate students progressing up to an advanced degree. There have been a few studies that have looked at the legal profession, but not a cross-disciplinary look that, you know, was, you know, inclusive of many different disciplines. I agree that the academic field is prone to this. It's highly competitive. It's very individualized. There's no room for, or there's little room for error, or at least the way that our climate is cultivated. But it would be very interesting to do more of a cross-disciplinary study and seeing if this is alive and well. I think that we would find it a lot in early career professionals, regardless of of the discipline.
If you're just starting it, yeah, if you're just starting out, you're feeling some of this. Julie, go ahead.
Yeah, and again, I don't come from the research side, but, you know, Holly mentioned the issue of competitive. And so I definitely see it in with professionals that I work with who are in highly competitive fields. They're surrounded by a lot of very highly talented peers, which is what they want. They want to be around a lot of smart people. And then they start to question, you know, I used to be the smartest person in the room. I'm not anymore.
That's right.
And
mm-hmm.
so I think it's those environments where, you know, and sometimes there are environments when you're evaluated, there's forced, you know, the people who aren't evaluated at a certain level will not be there anymore. So there's often a lot of high stakes involved mm-hmm. around performance and assessment.
Let me get an email from John on the air. He says, John here, masquerading as a mechanical engineer with 25 plus years experience. Someone once told me the more you know or realize that you don't know, it's a catch 22. I know the more experience I get, the more I see I don't have. And then he ends by saying a praise on me. And there's some truth to that, Holly, which is, and maybe that's not the imposter syndrome, but just sort of the humbling idea that even when you're really good at what you do, you haven't mastered the whole thing.
Exactly. And that's why when we first started the show and you asked about a definition, I said the persistent experience of inadequacy, because as you progress in a career, the level of uncertainty about what this career is about and how I'll perform tends to decrease. But you still, when you move into other areas or maybe you experience a challenge, because you're primed already for this experience, it tends to come quicker. You recognize it more. Right. So it's never really a matter of feeling like I know everything, because having been now in the profession for 20 years and at the University of Houston for 11 years now, I can tell when it starts creeping up, and it's usually around situations that are unfamiliar or where I have some uncertainty around.
Or high stakes for whatever
or
reason.
High stakes, exactly. But the great thing is that I can recognize it. I can have a couple coping mechanisms that I'll use with it. I'll talk to my graduate students about it so that they feel like this is a real situation and or an experience that some of them may experience. Some of them might won't. They haven't. But to really normalize the conversation, and I talked to our department chairs, and I talk to other people about having this as a part of onboarding and orientation, so that our new faculty, our new graduate students, understand that this could be an experience, and if it's so, have conversations about it. You're not alone in this.
Let me squeeze. We can't get the caller, but I'll just read what it says on my screen. Eloise from Wayne says, there's a man in particular who's first in the family, has a PhD. How can she support someone who is suffering from this feeling of being an imposter? What do you suggest, Julie, for people who love or live with people who feel like they're a fraud?
Well, I think first, allowing them to talk about it and, sharing with them how you see them and, their strengths, their competencies, their contributions, their impact, and encouraging them to seek that out. I also think there's the awareness of that Holly said that, this is situational and that this is not who you are. And so accept it and look forward to what's next, what you're going to be building on. That the person you talked about who has the 25 years experience,
right,
because you have that experience, you can handle what comes up because you have the competencies and the mm-hmm. experience. It's not I have to be fearful of what I'm not going to know. It's I have the tools to navigate this because my history shows that.
A perfect place to end our conversation. Julie Cohen, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times. And she's a CEO of Julie Cohen Coaching. Holly Hutchins, thank you for joining us on Radio Times
thank
as
you.
Well. Associate Professor of Human Resource Development at the University of Houston's College of Technology. And we appreciate all those phone calls to Radio Times. You can also send us an email. You can follow us on Facebook. Follow us, download a podcast of the program as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.